the weekend, and that means new movies are out, which means only one thing. Welcome to John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
I'm very excited about this. This will be fun. Or should I not be excited about it?
I would love it if you would be excited about it. At least you'd be excited about something. So. And now, John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
Hi, I'm John Serba. You're listening to my podcast, I Hate Your Favorite Movie. I'm here, as usual, with Eric Hultgren, MLive guy, marketing guy, movie fan. I'm MLive and Advance Digital Film Critic. And we're going to talk about Jason Bourne this week. This is one, probably my most anticipated movie of the summer. And we'll get into that in a minute here. We're going to talk about Bad Moms. And we'll get into something that it's a slight twist on the usual formula here.
I love the twists.
Yeah, so hang around for that. Jason Bourne. You know his name. That's not his real name, though. I think we figured that out. That's where the new movie picks up, pretty much exactly where the old one left off. It drops in a reminder. The old movie is now 9 years old, I believe.
Wow.
Bourne Ultimatum was 2007. And I stand by my assertion that might be the best action movie of the past 10 years. Like pure action. I mean, the genre of action movies kind of blurs because is the Avengers an action movie? I don't know.
Right, right. What superhero, what do its own genre, right? Like all of that stuff, yeah.
How
do I make sense of all of this?
I was actually coming up with a list. Like maybe I should list the best action movie of the past 10 years. And I'm like, I don't know what qualifies. I mean, do we just want like the guy, like you have an action star in the action movie, and he is in action, and then that's that defined. I mean,
he is in action, therefore it is an action movie.
Or you know, like. Is the movie built around action sequences? Well, you could argue that so many movies are built around action sequences. So I don't know. I'm mulling that. Everyone out there, email me, jserba@mlive.com. Tell me what defines an action movie, please. All 6.4 of you who are listening.
And then once we define what it is, we'll create a list.
Sure. So, but Jason Bourne, this is the return of Matt Damon to the franchise. Obviously, we know that.
This is what you would call the Deadpool of Jason Bourne movies. Like, we're really sorry about that Jeremy Renner thing that we did. We're fixing it. We promise.
Well yeah. I mean, I think there's a point where director Paul Greengrass, who did the Bourne Ultimatum and the Bourne Legacy,
Supremacy.
Bourne Supremacy.
The Bourne Identity,
was the second
or whatever
one.
Yeah.
But Bourne Legacy was the Jeremy Renner
yes.
one. So Paul Greengrass directed the last two Matt Damon Bourne films. And you kind of got the sense like, okay, let's move on to something else. He and Matt Damon felt that way. And so they made this one with Jeremy Renner and no one really cared about it, you know. I mean, it was a similar formula, different names, different faces. And not as well done, frankly.
Well, and I think if you were a fan of the books, at this point, obviously Ludlum has passed and they're being written by another person. But
yeah.
The Bourne Legacy, the name of the book, you know, they borrowed that in name only. Like the storyline in the Bourne Legacy would have been very cool to see Matt Damon actually flesh it out. So,
oh, sure.
Which, not just, I don't know what happens in Jason Bourne, but. In the Bourne Legacy, you know, it turns out he has a kid in Southeast Asia who ends up being an assassin who tries to kill him, and that's what the Bourne Legacy is about.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Jeremy Renner movie was not about any. It was about being in the mountains and drones trying to kill you and sort of being Hawkeye, but not really being Hawkeye.
Even Hawkeye is not really being Hawkeye. He's
right.
Like the least of the Avengers.
Right.
What do you do? I shoot arrows.
At things. All the things.
Yeah. I can hit things with arrows.
Yes. And occasionally I can put people on the arrows and shoot those at other things, too.
So, Jason Bourne, the Bourne Ultimatum is the ultimate. And
Jason Bourne is born to run.
Is that what the movie is? Is it just him running?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, it's 123 minutes. I bet 100 of those minutes are him are chase oriented, of various speeds. You know, I mean, there's like there's a sequence set in Athens during a very convenient moment of civil unrest and protest on the streets. There's a sequence set in London. Then there's a sequence set in Las Vegas. There are multiple stops in between in Iceland and DC and Langley, Virginia, and all that. If a Bourne movie does not have at least 14 different countries typed out at the bottom of the screen, it's not fulfilling its promise. If Jason Bourne doesn't walk around like he, you know, it would be child's play for him to just walk into a movie theater and not have to pay. You know, he walks with such confidence. He knows where he's going and what he's doing, even though he's improvising. You know, and that's the joke. It's like, if you walk like you know where you're going, you can walk right past the usher, and they don't have to rip your ticket, because it's like, hey, I've already been in here. That is Jason Bourne times 100.
Yes.
Because if he's walking through a crowd,
your ability to sneak into Studio 28 is not, you're not on the level of Jason Bourne, really.
Studio
Good
28.
Good for you,
now,
but like.
RIP Studio 28.
Yes, I know. That's why I picked it, so all the stories could die with that theater, so you wouldn't have to out anything that you're currently doing.
If Jason Bourne is in a crowd, he will find the person whose ID badge he needs to get into a building, and he'll bump into, and he's a pickpocket. You know, he's a master everything. He's a master pickpocket. He's a master shot. He's a master pugilist, because where the story picks up, he is this, you know, he's living off the grid. He knows who his real self is. He's got these massive identity questions. You know, the Bourne identity was always about who is Jason Bourne and who is he really? And now he knows that. So we're beyond that, but now he wants to find out more about who he is. And so he has these kind of like whoosh, whoosh flashbacks happening at various times. So there's a little bit of character wedged into the various sequences of him walking very fast, punching people. speaking of punching people, pugilist. I digress slightly.
Yes, that's okay.
At the beginning of the movie, he's just like living off the grid in Greece, you know, bare knuckle fighting in like these obviously non-legit competitions.
Right, because they're like in the middle of nowhere, and
we all saw that in the trailer.
Yep.
Where he walks up, bam, he clobbers a guy, and that's it. You know, he just pulls a wrap off his hands. So you know, he's still the two words I wrote in my notebook while watching this movie is super soldier. I mean, he's like Captain America, but slightly.
Right.
I don't think Jason Bourne is going to be jumping out of airplanes without parachutes anytime soon. But you know, he can take a bullet. He can take several punches. He can take a headbutt. He could probably take a knife. You know, he could take any number of things. He could probably take a landmine. You know, he is pretty much indestructible, like most action stars. Paul Greengrass, you know, there's a story here where Tommy Lee Jones plays the head of the CIA, and he's, you know, developing another Bourne-type program, which is going to involve, you know, brainwashing and programming human beings to be these kind of cold-blooded assassins like Jason Bourne is. And now he's struggling with that. Some of his flashbacks are of the people he's killed, you know. I believe they mentioned in this movie that he's killed 32 people, and he's trying to come to terms with that, with his new self, his new consciousness. And his father is tied into all this. So there's some interesting, you know, character stuff happening there. But then there's also a character who is the head of a Facebook-type social media site that has 5 billion users, and it's called Deep Dream. The character is played by Riz Ahmed. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. And you know, he and Tommy Lee Jones are at heads because Tommy Lee Jones wants the CIA to have access to all that information. So that ties into the story as well and leads up to this sequence in Las Vegas, which is amazing. It is so brilliantly executed by Paul Greengrass that it's like, okay, this is why we're here. I mean, there's some good stuff
up to
that point, you know, but like there's that scene in Morocco in the Bourne Ultimatum, which I think is better. You know, this is just kind of this Jason Bourne Vegas sequence is kind of more.
It's very Vegas. The Vegas version of Jason Bourne.
Whereas Morocco, that was like a 10-minute chunk that was just brilliant from beginning to end. And this is like, it has that typical like chaos, crowds, shots fired, bumping into people, car chase, physical man-to-man confrontation. The car chase is just remarkable. I mean, I felt myself kind of levitating off the seat for a while. You know, you're like, it is really tense. And people criticize Greengrass because he does that shaky cam camera style. I sat a few rows further back in the theater than I normally do, just because that tends to, you know, that can be kind of a uncomfortable experience if you're sitting too close. And but, you know, if you compare to what Greengrass does to, say, Alfonso Cuarón with Gravity, who created tension by not editing, just have these really long takes without cuts. And that's just like, I liken that to holding your breath.
Sure. Well, and that's what that movie felt like.
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely. You're in the vacuum of space. Of course, you're holding your breath.
But I mean, even the set pieces, right? You're like that tension as it builds. You feel yourself holding your breath because you don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, whereas what Greengrass does is the opposite. You are breathing heavy and fast. You know. And the thing that I kind of laugh at, because the music always plays to that. It's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's just nonstop for 2 hours. It's just like that music is just like constantly, you know, it's just tapping you on the shoulder the whole time, like, hey, 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 hey. And you just like, ah, it kind of aggravates you. And that's the point, you know, it wants you to be physically involved with what's happening on the screen. And that's what makes this movie worthwhile, absolutely, absolutely worthwhile as an action film, because there's that immediacy there. Greengrass is one of the few directors who can use that kind of handheld shaky cam, you know, million edits a second style and make it effective. You know, so many times there are, I don't know, what comes to the top of my head of a terrible shaky cam movie, like that Tyler Perry film where he plays the same character that Morgan Freeman does in Along Came a Spider.
Oh, yeah.
I'm blanking on it. But that is just like, is the cinematographer wasted? How many beers did he drink before he started shooting this movie? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's like... Instead of making the people move, let's just move the camera a lot, you know. And this has a little bit of both, you know. It has the balance of like that camera movement where you're almost ducking, you know.
Yep.
You feel like you need to duck or dodge or parry or, you know, it's coming right at us and you move. And movies quite often don't accomplish that, you know. They want to get you involved like that, or they're just, you know, they're too poorly made
right.
to actually accomplish this. So Jason Bourne, absolutely. I like it about as much as any of the other entries that aren't Bourne Ultimatum or Bourne Ultimatum. Ultimato.
Yes.
Would you like an ultimate tomato?
Yes.
So I highly recommend it. It's a good 2 hours. Matt Damon has about 14 lines in the entire movie. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like the anti-Martian, where all where he just kind of talked to himself the whole time.
The anti-Martian.
and you kind of look at it and you go, Matt Damon has that kind of charisma. You know, he can deliver a good line. So maybe he should have more. But this is a very poker faced kind of movie. It's worth noting that Alicia Vikander, who recent Oscar winner, newcomer, plays a cyber expert for the CIA, and so she's new to the movie. She was in The Danish Girl. That's what she won her Oscar for. She was in Ex Machina. Have you seen Ex Machina?
Yes.
She plays the robot.
Yeah.
So.
And if I meet people that have not seen it, I get very sad.
Yeah.
I'm sad for you for not seeing this.
It's movie. A terrific, terrific sci-fi movie. She's in this. This is not an actor's movie, mind you. She's there as sort of a. The end of the CIA that has more of a conscience than the Tommy Lee Jones character, who's this sort of he's not a Dick Cheney type. He's more mobile than Dick Cheney, but he is a like national security at all costs kind of guy.
Yeah,
and she talks her way into helping him secure Jason Bourne, and you know there's security breach because there's you know. Hacking
because
the
they're always,
and and thankfully this movie gets that sequence out of the way where the like honchos of the CIA stand there in a room with you know 900 screens in it, and there's a bunch of people tapping away at computers like this, and camera six, and it zooms in on Bourne as he's making his way through a crowd, and gets that out of the way early.
When you know, wonder,
but these movies, it's like that's the other thing this movie needs to fulfill is that like high tech action thriller.
But I wonder, 1.5 seasons into Mr. Robot, if we expect more out of that particular scene, you know, in the way that show is able to show it on a low tech, you know, a ragtag team of right, like.
Well, I haven't seen Mr. Robot. So,
well, so but. I mean, but essentially, like it's. Been a season and a half of them doing that, but just with laptops. I wonder if these scenes, because I already can close my eyes and picture that scene without having seen it, because they all do the same scene.
Yeah.
I wonder if we're at the point where we need to up the level of what that scene can actually do, because the facial recognition and, you know, we're in Heathrow Airport and there's Jason Bourne and we zoom in and there happens to be an assassin already waiting there because he loves the bagels. So he's going to go because he brought his sniper rifle backpack because it's Tuesday and he's going to go in the right, like... That scene needs to perhaps be fleshed out a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and the assassin in this movie is played by Vincent Cassell. He's only known as the asset.
Yes.
And, of course, he ties into the story in multiple ways. But he's like Tommy Lee Jones, guy on the ground. You know, he's the bad killer, you know. And it obviously leads up to a pretty satisfying confrontation, you know. It just kind of changes the names and faces a little bit. Instead of David Strathairn and Joan Allen barking the orders up in the office, the blue lit office,
barking
at minions at computers, you know,
Jason Bourne.
You've got Tommy Lee Jones, who has like. He has enough character in his face for 10 people at this point.
Right,
you know,
right.
The bags under his eyes have bags under their eyes, which have bags.
That talk to one another.
Yeah, I mean, there are faces in the bags under his eyes. And if anyone is going to stand around barking things, it's Tommy Lee Jones. I mean, he established himself as the guy who stands around and barks things, you know, 23 years ago when The Fugitive came out. So I like Jason Bourne. Did it meet my expectations? I think so. I mean, I think I had fairly modest to high expectations. It's not meeting everybody's expectations. It's not getting great reviews so far. But the theater last night was fairly full. I think people are a little starved for something that's got some pedigree and a level of decent interest to it this summer, and I think it's going to do pretty well.
And perhaps a sequel that we might have been waiting for, as opposed to the rest of the
exactly,
summer.
Exactly, exactly. This is a welcome sequel.
Yes, welcome, Jason. Come on in, Jason Bourne. We've been waiting for you.
Yeah. You know, the rare, one of those rare, well, they're not as rare as they used to be, but a franchise that is actually as liked by critics as it is by the general movie-going audience. So, go see it.
I will. Absolutely. It's on my list. As is what you're going to say next.
Yeah. Next up, Bad Moms. The world has turned upside down that I enjoyed Bad Moms as much as I did. Because looking at this, it has all the telltale signs of stuff that you just like, this is going to be so formulaic and corny. And it kind of is, but you care about the characters. It's actually quite funny. You know, I laughed way more times than I expected to, you know, and like being the only like guy by himself sitting in the entire theater.
Yes.
You know, it kind of illustrates how maybe I'm not the target audience for this, but I think there's enough of that. Well, you know, it's calculated to be along the lines of so many guys talking crass comedies, you know.
Right.
There are so many of them. Yes. Every Judd Apatow movie, for the most part, is just, you know, Seth Rogen and James Franco, you know, talking gutter language about women. And this is an obvious calculation to kind of flip that script. And, you know, in a sense, this succeeds where Ghostbusters kind of failed in just that base level of being, well, reasonably well-written, you know. Ghostbusters was a garbage script. It had a garbage screenplay.
Totally.
And this is like, shows us absolutely nothing new, really. And my dukes were up because it's like, Mila Kunis, I like her, but are you going to buy her as this kind of harried mom who's kind of an outcast at the PTA? You know what I mean? I don't know if I necessarily would buy her as that, but she does a reasonably decent job of making us give a rip about what happens to her. And she and the two other principals in this, Kristen Bell and Catherine Hahn, they're the... Belle is the completely harried stay-at-home mom. She has four kids. You know, Mila Kunis has two like around 10-year-old kids, and Catherine Hahn is the single mom. She's slutty. You know, she has no problem like dropping her kid off at school and trying to pick up on the dads who are dropping their kids off, regardless of whether they're married or not. And she steals a good half dozen scenes that are just laugh out loud funny. And she really, like, if anyone is going to goose this movie, she gooses it. Bam! You know, she like, jabs at you real good. Like, poke, wake up, poke, wake up, poke, wake up every 20 minutes or so. Which is exactly what the movie needs. Basic premise is Mila Kunis's character, you know, it has this kind of perfection ideal of what being the perfect mom is. She works, she takes care of everything at home, she drives the kids to school, she drives them to soccer practice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Her husband is this kind of dope who... You get the sense he isn't a terrible person, but you know, she refers to him as basically being her third child, so she's things are not going well, and she reaches her breaking point. You know, the marriage is rough, the mommying is rough, work is rough, everything's rough. She has like a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day.
Well done, sir.
And just
snaps. You know, she walks into the PTA meeting, and the head of the PTA is Christina Applegate, who's just like, does everything but, you know, make the PTA, all her PTA underlings Sig Heil her. You know, I mean, she's just like the perfect mom. She has all the money, and she, you know, she's rich and blah 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 blah. So she's the foil for Mila Kunis's character. You know, you can't have light without darkness, as always.
Yes.
And so, one of the things I didn't like about the movie was like, okay, I'm gonna run for PTA president, and so now you have this like corny plot thing happening.
Right.
Like, we have to throw in this plot element. We can't just let this be about characters and people. We have to make her, you know, run for PTA president. And you just kind of, thankfully, it doesn't like really emphasize all that. But it does have a lot of really funny scenes where Mila and Catherine Hahn and Kristen Bell just kind of say the hell with it and they let rip. Those are the kind of like big crowd pleaser scenes. You know, there's a great one where they're tipsy and they just and Belle's character's like, I have to go to the grocery store, so they go to the grocery store and they're just, you know, grabbing vodka off the shelves and pouring it down their throats. This is an R-rated movie, mind you, and it's actually kind of refreshing. Even though it's a little canned and corny at times, there are a lot of moments where you sit there and go, real people do talk like this. You know, it has a bit of that, like that Judd Apatow flavor where, okay, this is kind of contrived to be a bigger than life comedy at times, but you also listen to the people talk and you go, you know, I have said similar things. I've heard people say similar things. So there is that kind of relatable element to it. Granted, it's very silly at times, but it never goes too bonkers, you know. And then it does kind of, if you're expecting nothing but raunch, it doles it out enough where it's actually effective. You know what I mean? It's not just, you know, one nasty stretch of dialogue after or a gross one gross out scene. There is not a gross out scene in this movie. Spoiler alert. But it's still really funny. Imagine that. So it kind of doles out the raunch in measured doses, and it does the same with kind of the sentiment. You know, Mila Kunis is struggling with her relationship with her young daughter, you know, who feels a lot of anxiety because of all the things she's involved in. And there's, you know, there's this kind of, the overall message is about kind of maybe everybody needs to live a little bit simpler life. And I sat there going, you know what? I have felt the same way so many times. You know, maybe we should simplify a little bit. So that bad moms, there's an element of like universal truth. just enough to make it a decent movie. I mean, it's not like, it's not a masterpiece. It's not like, oh my gosh, this is a director's movie. Not at all. It's not really even a writer's movie. It's just, you know, a good, decent, strong performance, you know, reasonably well-written movie. What do you expect out of it? That kind of emotional roller coaster from the high of a laugh to a kind of sweet sentimental moment. Does them well.
Awesome.
Imagine that.
Right.
I mean, this movie was on my least anticipated list of the summer. Like, I saw the trailers for it and went, really? Do we really have to have to sit through an hour and 40 minutes of cliches?
And that brings us to the lesson of this week, that even John Serba can change.
Yeah, exactly.
There's room for everyone to grow.
I don't hate everything. I wanted to hate this movie, and it won me over.
After
just, you wanted to hate it, it just wanted to snuggle. And here we are.
I do like to snuggle.
Who doesn't?
And now.
And now, John Serba hates your favorite movie is...
Yeah, so, well, out of this week's new releases that I saw, Bad Moms and Jason Bourne, both of them pretty good. So what is a hater to do? Well, earlier this week, the past 2 weeks, I've been working on a project where I've been going over summer blockbusters, the best and worst summer blockbusters ever. And we're talking dating back to Jaws. Jaws is considered to be the first big, like, modern-style summer blockbuster. So I went back, you know, roughly 40 years and came up with 25 of the best, 25
Now, did you go back and watch all of these or just kind of like...
Oh, I've seen them all, bro.
I know, bro. But I wonder if context changes. That's all.
Well, you know, not necessarily. I mean, did I really want to go back and watch Transformers, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
I was just asking.
No, I just wanted to kind of reflect on...
Because this list is epic.
Yeah, it is.
This list is the hot fire.
Yeah, actually. And the criteria is...
Is Michael Bay directed it.
Or Roland Emmerich.
That takes 11 of the 25 out of the list.
And I was inspired by this because this year has had a lot of really terrible summer blockbuster hopefuls, you know? And I kind of wanted to remember the good times. And then, of course, I have to uphold my image, and I remember the bad
times. This list is
much
more fun, to be quite honest with you.
Guess which one more people read.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. They
Well, because you naturally, like, I think even if I wanted to know what your top 25 is that you love, and I'll read that one next, right? Mm-hmm. I think you're naturally inclined to go to see where you align with a critic's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got a list in my mind of 25 terrible movies. You know, I've only walked out of, I know you can't, you're not allowed to, you're a critic. I've only walked out of two movies in my entire life, right? So those automatically make the list. And then you've got another list on top of those lists, and you just want to see how many of these you would go, yeah, that's an awful movie.
Well, you know, there's a couple where I differed from... Most of the time, people are going to look at this list and go, yeah, this is a bunch of garbage. A couple of them where I might differ from the mainstream opinion was like, you know... And the other criteria was it had to be released between May and August.
Right, it had to be summer,
you know?
Yeah.
I know May is technically spring, but the summer, quote-unquote summer movie season, If we were writing an article,
worst summer storms, then yes, you have to stick with what meteorologically would be actual summer, but we're not meteorologists.
No. And
I barely qualify as a critic. So.
But we can read a calendar.
Sure, and that Batman came out in May, so heretofore summer.
Yeah, well that's, you know, the summer movie season starts in May.
Yep.
That's it. So yeah, open between May and
I'm trying to figure out
August.
What on this list people would differ with you on.
People love the Fast and Furious movies.
Oh, that would be it.
They really do. And in fact, a lot of critics have enjoyed the last few Fast and Furious movies. And I just, what am I missing? Am I missing anything?
Well, I think it's formulaic. It's got an ensemble cast. It hits all the notes it's supposed to hit. It doesn't surprise you. And I think in some cases, when you look at a year like this, we want that at this point because we've sat through all of this dirge for 2.5 months and we're like, please give me something that I know will do what it's supposed to do.
Okay, Jason Bourne does what it's supposed
to
do.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying.
Fast and Furious does what it's supposed to do, and it's lame.
Okay.
My issue with the Fast and Furious movies is, like, do they have to be so dang complicated? The Bourne movies are complicated in a way that kind of at least makes you think about something like, oh, national security and social media and blah, 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 blah. What does Fast and Furious make you think about? We're family. And family sticks together. You know, that's it is corny stuff. You know, Jason Bourne doesn't even pretend to be like very emotional. It's just like, here is some awesome action.
I think the other
and
thing,
it is a little more intellectual.
I think the other thing to consider, though, is that the number of Fast and Furious movies keeps Vin Diesel employed long enough to make another action movie that has to do with some sort of sci-fi thing that he actually wants to do, like Pitch Black 7 or whatever.
The Last Witch Hunter?
The Last Witch Hunter. This allows us to enjoy The Last Witch Hunter. We wouldn't be able to do that if there weren't Fast and Furious movies to pay his mortgages.
Anyway, yeah, so I differ on the Fast and Furious movies. I actually didn't get any feedback on hating on the Fast. I've gotten a lot of feedback. I actually blocked people on Twitter because they were so vehemently angry at me for not liking the last Fast and Furious movie. I just like, okay, I feel threatened. You're done. You're out. I'm out.
I feel
I'm
threatened.
Not participating in this conversation. Just not a fan. It's this. It's too CG for me. One of the dumbest action scenes I've ever seen.
This whole
seen.
List just makes me... I'm just going through the list back and forth because it just makes me smile backwards and forwards.
One of the dumbest action scenes I've ever seen is... cars don't fly. So lame. And I love the fact that... I think it's Fast and Furious 6, which is on my list. Most of these opened in April. They're like... they take advantage of there not being a whole lot of competition out there. And I think that's part of the reason Fast and Furious is as popular as it is. There's just not a whole lot of tentpole-style films that opened in April. Fast and Furious 6 opened during the summer. That scene, the sequence at the end of Fast and Furious 6 with the airplane, where like someone actually like figured out if an airplane actually... rolled down a tarmac, it would have to be so many miles long. Because it just rolls down this tarmac for like 10 minutes of movie time. And you're like, if it's going at this speed, and so don't apply any science to Fast and Furious. The other one that I got a little bit of feedback on for including in this list was Fatal Attraction. Have you seen Fatal Attraction as a critical thinker?
I have seen Fatal Attraction, and I will say two things. One, I did not know it came out during the summer, because I just was,
yeah.
It was
yeah.
In 87, I was 14, I didn't care, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And two, I mean, I watched it and just had really no reaction to it. I think there are better psychotic movies out there.
I think if you're 20 years old in 1987, it might stick with you as a you know, it's like, it's one of those like hyper melodramas that we look at now, and it's hilarious how overwrought it is. You know, that whole boiled bunny thing is so funny, but it was so shocking in 1987.
Right.
It doesn't hold up. It doesn't hold up. And that ending is dumb. It's that like, she's dead. No, she's not. Friday the 13th horse crap.
Right.
And I know a lot of people probably have a lot of nostalgia for this movie, but I don't know. It just doesn't hold up. It's funny how my best movie blockbusters, like the top five, was dominated by Steven Spielberg. And the bottom five is dominated by Michael Bay.
Yes.
Although, like, where did Armageddon was 7. Let's see, Pearl Harbor 3. Harbor is one of the most, like, I don't know what Michael Bay was thinking, because you want to kind of pay homage to one of the great tragedies in American history, and he exploits it for explosions. It's just, I mean, set aside the fact that, you know, it has this just, like, horrible love triangle in it that is just not convincing on any level. And like poor Beckinsale, poor Josh Hartnett, poor Affleck, they're all just like reciting the worst dialogue, and they're just the terrible characters, and he's dead, but he really isn't dead. You know, one of my favorite reviews of this movie, Roger Ebert said Pearl Harbor is a movie about how World War II upset a love triangle. I paraphrase. I don't know the exact one. Pearl Harbor. And then number one, Transformers. Pick a Transformers movie. Any Transformers movie. It can be. It could be number one. I picked Revenge of the Fallen, which is what, the second one?
Yeah, it's
the second one. In this nigh endless franchise, there's like four more being made. I picked the second one because that one I think was the least comprehensible of all of them. Others have been longer, but
even
like
more incomprehensible than the last one. The last one was kind of ridiculous.
Well, the last one, like Michael Bay, I think Michael Bay learned something, which shocks me. Michael Bay learned something. He learned to pull the camera back a little bit.
Gotcha.
In the last two films. So where it's like, instead of just like whirling nonsense junk shots, there are less of them. There are more like, who is fighting what? I can't tell in Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. More scenes of just like, is this a good robot? Is this a bad robot?
Right.
Is it transforming?
Yes.
Is it not? Is it breaking?
is
it being destroyed or is it becoming something greater? I can't tell. I just really think Revenge of the Fallen is terrible. Just terrible. Terrible. Just terrible.
Just awful.
Just terrible. You know, and I think Revenge of the Fallen had like the robot with the old man robot with the cane
with the beard. Yes.
Yeah. Did it have the Transformer with the testicles?
That's the one.
Yeah. Okay. This is the most awful one, easily by far.
Where it makes the Constructicons and somehow they need to have testicles. Because that's what it missed in the cartoon was the fact that it wasn't anatomically correct. When I was a kid, I always thought, why isn't this anatomically correct? Clearly.
Robots.
If the construction crew outside of my house were to form into a robot, it would need to be anatomically correct, because where would it go to the bathroom? That would be the second question I would have.
Is this one with the like urban speak robots too? Or was that the third one?
Even if you're wrong, I'm just going to say yes for the sake of making this movie work.
All the movies just blur together. I can't remember any of them. The only way I can differentiate them is because it's like, hey, the first three had Shia LaBeouf. And the last one had Mark Wahlberg. There's some line of demarcation there. But there are more with Mark Wahlberg being made, so those are going to all blur together too. It's something. It's really something to kind of. I'm not that person who says my childhood has been ruined by the Ghostbusters remake. I loved Transformers when I was a kid. You know, I played with the toys. I read the comics. I watched the cartoon, all that stuff. But they don't need to be made aggressively phallic.
right.
Like Michael Bay does. I mean, it's just like, there's just some base level subtext happening there. It's just really kind of upsetting and gross.
So one last question about this list before why Jaws 2 versus Jaws 3D?
Well, that's part of my criteria, because Jaws 3D did not perform all that well.
Got it. Okay.
So these movies
have to do well and be terrible.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. This list is like, why did people go see these movies?
Fair enough.
So Jaws 2 was a hit. Jaws 3D, I think, might have been a decent sized hit for the time.
But doesn't hold up in the pantheon of summer blockbusters.
Yeah, exactly. You can look at Jaws 2 and it's like that made more than $100 million in 1979. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know. So that's where the criteria draws the line between like a hit summer blockbuster and a bomb. You know, Ishtar does not belong on this list.
All right.
You know?
Fair enough, yes.
that was a summer hopeful. One tidbit of information that I learned watching this, two tidbits. One, remember how bad Kevin Costner's accent was in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
No, and I don't want to.
what was he thinking? And two, in 1988,
one of the greatest action films. Speaking of action films, probably the greatest modern action film ever made, Die Hard, came out. Guess what outgrossed it by more than $20 million.
I was just you have it in here, and I just
Crocodile Dundee 2.
Now, but there to you be go. You know, to be fair, not to make this podcast go any longer than your predetermined time frame, which it is right now. But like, I wonder if some of these are the audience being tricked into thinking that it's going to, you know, like, I'm going to go see Jaws 2 because Jaws changed my life. I'm going to go see Crocodile Dundee 2 because that's not a knife, right?
Yeah. Like, well, you know, and obviously that happened. It was a different time then, though, where Crocodile Dundee 2, you know, probably played in the theaters for 6 or 8 or 9 months, where now it would be there 2 months tops.
Right.
You know, it's just such a, and marketing is such a huge thing. You know, movie marketing is way bigger, more prevalent, all that stuff. Blame Star Wars for that, really. I mean, wasn't Star Wars the first thing to have its own Burger King glass?
Yep.
You know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's, I think there's more tricking going on now. There's more of that psychological manipulation where you have to see this movie and you've got to see it now. That's the way things are marketed now. I think Crocodile Dundee 2 was one of those that just kind of coasted on the goodwill of the first movie.
The goodwill of our love of Australia.
I guess. Go roast shrimp on a Barbie. This has been the I Hate Your Favorite Movie podcast.
Good day, mates.
Good day, mates. Next week, let's talk Suicide Squad, won't we?
We will.
Yeah.